The Church of God, the Eternal, presents Origins of Babylon in Ancient History, number 1. The second message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Babylon, Past, Present, and Future. Given for the afternoon service of the first high day of the Feast of Tabernacles, in Eugene, Oregon, September 30th, 2023.
So on this afternoon service of the first high day of Tabernacles, as you know, I provided an introduction to you last night of the series that I am giving. We are going to talk about Babylon. I don't think I gave you the overall theme title, but I entitled this entire series of eight messages that I have for this feast. I've entitled it Babylon, Past, Present, and Future. And so last night in the introduction, we actually spent most of our time in the book of Revelation, and we worked backward from Revelation 20. We looked at the end result, which is the happy ending with the return of Jesus Christ, the establishment of his kingdom. We see and we understand that he is going to vanquish his enemies, and his enemy can be summarized, encapsulated by the term Babylon. And so whatever this Babylon is, it's important for you and me to understand it. Not all the details of how physically it's going to come to pass in the last days in world events, because the intent of those prophecies are to help the called people of God to recognize what we need to know. In other words, what's going to be on our final exam? What's going to be on the test for you and me that determines whether we are ones that God accepts into his eternal family or not? So that's what we need to focus upon concerning Babylon. And so whatever it is, God says, come out of it. How are we going to do that if we can't identify exactly what it is that we need to escape? So if being part of Babylon is deadly to God's people, and it is, how can you and I identify what it is and then how to avoid getting caught up in it? And as I already mentioned to you, by nature, you and I are already caught up in it. So don't think this is something you've been separated from up till now. And now your plan is to say how not to get sucked into it. You are in it. You have been in it. And I'm not going to prove that to you right away, but by the end of this feast, I'm going to try to prove that to you so that you understand really where Babylon is and what it is that God wants from us. By default, you and I are part of it. So can we recognize that, and then how do we set a plan for ourselves to escape it? Because God didn't say avoid getting caught in it. He said, come out of her, my people. So we are in it, and we have to come out. So what's the origin of Babylon? We need to find the root of it, don't we? And then track it forward in history. But I'm going to do it a little backward because We're going to keep doing it backward rather than from the beginning forward. But I'll start by asking this question. Where was then the origin of this Babylon, this organization, this cabal, if you will, that is so dominant, especially in the very last days, that incorporates all nations and all leaders of all of the nations, and in fact, as I read to you last night, all inhabitants of the earth. Where did that start? Maybe it was King Nebuchadnezzar. Because after all, Nebuchadnezzar was king of Babylon, right? And we're going to read through right now some of those statements that God gave in the Bible, and especially one of the prophecies in Daniel, which speaks about Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar as that golden head of this symbolic image. So if Nebuchadnezzar, by God's account, calls him the head, Maybe Babylon begins with Nebuchadnezzar. Well, let's go through and find out. As we know, Israel was taken into captivity by none other than Babylon. Let's notice Jeremiah 20. I'm keeping this very succinct. There's so many passages I could refer to in the Old Testament, and I'm really picking out the bullet points to show you the tapestry of the thread that we want to see. Jeremiah 20, verses 4 and 5. Jeremiah was sent by God to give a very unpopular message to the leaders of the southern kingdom of Judah, and in this place to an apostate governor in Judah named Pashur. Poor old Jeremiah. You know, how would you like to have an assignment like him, where God sends you to tell a people everything they hate and despise and don't want to hear, but that's your job? And you know the old saying, right? Don't shoot the messenger. But that's what human beings do. They take it out on the one who brings them the bad news. And that's why Jeremiah was so persecuted the majority of his life, because he was sent by God with a true message, but a very unpopular message. And here's an excerpt from just one of many. Jeremiah 20, verse 4. Here's what Jeremiah says to this apostate governor. For thus saith the Eternal, behold, I will make thee a terror to thyself and to all thy friends, and they shall fall by the sword of their enemies, and thine eyes shall behold it. And I will give all Judah into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he shall carry them captive into Babylon and shall slay them with the sword. Now, what if you were this governor in Judah and the other leaders who were still enjoying a certain amount of autonomy? And so they were all patriots. We're the people of God. We have a right to the blessing. And now this prophet comes along and says, you're going to lose everything. And all the people are going to be taken into Babylonian captivity and shipped out of their own country and their homeland. You're going to lose it all. No, we're not. How dare you say such a thing? That's one of the reasons they persecuted Jeremiah, because he told them they were losers. And they did not want to acknowledge it or accept it, but it all came to pass, didn't it? So he says, speaking in the name of God, I will give all Judah into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he shall carry them captive into Babylon and shall slay them with the sword. Verse 5, moreover, God says, I will deliver all the strength of this city, meaning Jerusalem, and all the labors thereof and all the precious things thereof and all the treasures of the kings of Judah will I give into the hands of their enemies, which shall spoil them and take them and carry them to Babylon. And that's exactly what happened. So there's a succinct summary of what God said he was going to do, and Babylon then was going to be the instrument through which he was going to punish these Jews because they would not be faithful to him and fulfill their covenant with him. And he warned them time and time again and gave them every opportunity, and they had a few good kings off and on along the way, but in the final analysis, they didn't like God, they didn't like his laws, and they did everything they could to incorporate Baal worship into their practices. So Babylon was going to be involved with Israel. Now go to Daniel 5. Here's a succinct summary concerning King Nebuchadnezzar and that first major Babylonian empire on the earth. We're going to call it a world ruling empire. Not that it necessarily dominated the entire circumference of the earth, but the known world. It certainly did. But now in Daniel 5, we have the prophecy being given to the son of Nebuchadnezzar concerning what his father was given by God. Here, verse 18 of Daniel 5, O thou king, And this is now being spoken to Belshazzar. The Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom. Oh, isn't that interesting? How did Babylon become a world ruling empire? God did it. Now that makes no sense, does it? Babylon is the enemy of God. Jesus Christ is ultimately going to have to destroy it. And yet this tells us that God empowered it. On the surface, that would seem incompatible unless you understand the purposes of this incredible God. No, he did empower Babylon. Babylon only became a world power to actually carry out all its influence and negativity and persecution upon Israel and upon the entire world because of the allowance and the sponsorship of the one true God. So let's understand why Babylon exists, even though it's evil. The Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew. And whom he would, he kept alive. And whom he would, he set up. And whom he would, he put down. I love that description of power. It's a very poetic way to describe ultimate power. He did whatever he chose to do. I'd call that all-encompassing power. So there's a description of Nebuchadnezzar as the king of Babylon in his day. Is this the origin? It was the most powerful manifestation that ancient kingdoms ever had. Well, notice first Jeremiah 28:14. Just to reinforce the fact that God is behind it all. Nothing happens without his permission or even, as I used the word before, sponsorship. Jeremiah 28:14. We're going to find that Babylon is actually an instrument God to humble his people. God uses these powers, these enemies, to accomplish a good purpose, even though what they do is evil. But they are used by God to accomplish a good purpose, which is exactly what Satan the devil, by the way, is doing right now. Why is there a devil? The world thinks, those who believe in a devil, let alone a creator God, then most religions believe that God and Satan are equals in power, vying with one another for the souls of men, yin and yang, pushing against offsetting one another in this dance of equilibrium. Not true. Satan the devil is the servant of God. God could absolutely nullify him at any moment. We already read last night, in Revelation 20, he's going to do that. And for 1,000 years, pictured by this Feast of Tabernacles, which we're keeping now, he's going to set him aside. And Satan doesn't get a vote. He doesn't get to push himself against God and say, no, I will not be put in a box for 1,000 years. I'm equal in power to you, so you have to deal with me. Mm-mm. Satan, whether he likes it or not, and no matter how much he hates God, he is the servant of the living God. That must frustrate him to no end. So the fact that Satan is allowed to roam and to do his nefarious work on the surface of this earth with peoples in the nations of the world is by the permission of God for an ulterior motive. And only for as long as God deems to let him. And in the very same way, so it was true with Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. Jeremiah 28:14, for thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, I have put a yoke of iron upon the neck of all these nations. Why are they enslaved? Why are they dominated by one other nation and king who gets to do whatever he wants his way? Because God made it possible. I have put a yoke of iron, God says, upon the neck of all these nations, that they may serve Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. And they shall serve him, and I have given him the beast of the field also. So why does Babylon exist? God. Now, that doesn't take away from the fact all that I read to you last night out of Revelation about how evil it is. This beast power being ridden by this woman symbolically called a whore. Mystery Babylon the Great, which is responsible for all of the evil, which Christ is going to vanquish at his second coming. Doesn't change any of that. But let's understand why it exists with God's permission and in even God's promotion. So now let's turn to Daniel 2, and we're going to read about that prophecy based upon the vision that Nebuchadnezzar had, which terrified him so much when he was seeking for an explanation. A prophet, a soothsayer, a magician, somebody who could explain what his dream signified. And no one could except for Daniel, because God inspired him to take the message of God and tell it to King Nebuchadnezzar. The prophetic image that we're going to read about here in Daniel 2 shows a succession of ruling kingdoms that would all be part of a single image. So as we read through this, keep this in mind. It's one image. And so different manifestations of Babylon through time are described here. And that's what Daniel explained to Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel 2, verse 31. I'm going to read through verse 45. Daniel 2, 31. Thou, O king, here's Daniel's inspired interpretation of the dream. Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. So this single image from head to toe, it's one image, it's one system. And yet, the quality of its makeup is declining over time. Where's the strongest, most valuable element of this image? It's in the head. And certainly then silver is valuable, but not as valuable by comparison as gold. And then brass is valuable, but not as valuable in comparison to silver, let alone of gold. And then iron, which is valuable, but not in comparison to brass or silver or gold. And then certainly, if you have something that is made of a mixture of iron and clay, you have something that is least valuable of all. And what's the interpretation? Well, let's keep reading. Verse 34, thou sawest, meaning in his dream, so what Nebuchadnezzar was showed by God, thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron and the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. So just stop and take note of the fact. These are manifestations of a kingdom, of a system upon this earth over many, many centuries, even millennia. It's one image, and yet which one of these kingdoms is going to receive the strike of this miraculous stone? The weapon, if you will, not made by the hands of any human being, which is going to strike where? The feet, meaning in the very last manifestation. But when it strikes and when it destroys, does it destroy just the feet? destroys everything that was ever a part of it. Because it says, then was the iron and clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together. The entire image is going to be destroyed. And became like the clay, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floor, and the wind carried them away that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. And you know what that is. That's the kingdom under Jesus Christ. That's the government of God upon this earth, because that's what's going to replace Babylon. And that's exactly what God inspired in the mind of this Babylonian king, even though he didn't understand it at all. Verse 36, this is the dream, as Daniel interprets it. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom. Again, so Daniel was inspired to tell Nebuchadnezzar, you didn't get this on your own. You aren't smarter or luckier. A power greater than you or any human being on earth is the one who put this in your hand. That's why you have it. The God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power and strength and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. So the head is first. It was the top, it was the most valuable, it was the most glorious manifestation. So it makes sense maybe for us to conclude that this is where Babylon began. Well, let's keep reading. Verse 39, and after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee. So this isn't just us making it up that the head of gold signified something that was more powerful or more valuable. This is the interpretation God gave. After thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. What they all have in common is that they all had their turn at dominating the earth. But each successive version of the system was weaker than the one before. However, it was still world ruling and dominating. Verse 40, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdues all things. We don't have any problem with the interpretation that Mr. Armstrong gave on this. This is historical. We're not talking about prophetic speculation about how details are going to unfold in the future. We're looking back, and we can do that. And it fits perfectly within the history upon this earth. One, we already know that the Babylonian kingdom was the first image, and it was preeminent. And then what? All you got to do is look at ancient history, and what kingdom rose after Babylon? Well, who dethroned the dynasty of Nebuchadnezzar? It was the Persian Empire, wasn't it? Sure it was. That's what the Bible shows. That's what secular history shows as well. So the Persian Empire displaced Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. And they took up the baton, if you will, to rule the earth and to dominate according to their whims. And then who displaced, who came after the Persians? Wasn't it the Greeks? Wasn't it Alexander the Great? Of course it was. So Alexander the Great, sponsored by God and given, as young as he was, the power militarily, the incredible strategic mind that he had and the gumption to apply himself. And because God was behind it, even though Alexander didn't recognize it, he was the one then who supplanted the Persians and dominated the known world at the time. He died when he was young, and then guess what happened? His kingdom was split into four different divisions according to his four chief generals. They all took a piece of the pie. And then what happened next? after the Greeks, then who came on the world scene to amalgamate power in the known world? Rome. The Roman Empire, which is synonymous with this portion of the image that was made out of iron that break in pieces. So all of that fits perfectly. It's looking in the rearview mirror. We have no problem with that. That just shows that secular history supports exactly what God said was going to happen in the Bible, hundreds and even thousands of years before it came to pass. Another confirmation of the one true God. So verse 40, again, the fourth kingdom, the Roman Empire, shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdues all things, and as iron that breaks all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And that, my dear friends, describes our day. Babylon is still here. It didn't go away. And its manifestation now in our age is this mixture of strength and weakness. And I mentioned to you last night, all of these nations who God says are part of it, doesn't mean they like each other, and they're certainly not unified. It is a testy coalition. It is, however, a coalition which is dominating the earth. It just has no comparison in strength and power and uniformity to that of the ones that preceded it. Verse 43, and whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. But they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. So it's an amalgamation, but it's a very fragile amalgamation and easily broken and fractured. But they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. Verse 44, and in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom. This tells you the time frame. You don't have to trust me that I'm telling you that the time of this version with iron mixed with clay is our time, because who's going to defeat this version of Babylon? Jesus Christ himself. In the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. Correlates exactly with what we read last night in Revelation. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. That's the one true King of kings and Lord of lords, Jesus Christ. And once he becomes king, there will never be another king. That's the last manifestation of a world ruling government that this earth will ever see. Babylon will be no more. And it shall stand forever. Verse 45, for as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands. The power that destroys Babylon is not human, supernatural. And that it break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold. Didn't just break the iron and the clay of the last manifestation in our age. This tells us that when it's destroyed, and we already know it's destroyed by Jesus Christ. We saw that on the Feast of Trumpets. It's going to destroy not only those who are part and parcel of it and leading it in our age on the earth right now, it's going to destroy every remnant of it from the past, back to its inception. Because it destroys also the brass, the silver, and the gold. The great God, it says, hath made known to the king, so said Daniel here, what shall come to pass hereafter in the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. So remember, you may have lost track. What's our point? What are we hunting for? We're hunting for the origin of Babylon. If you go by Daniel 2, you say, what's the origin? Well, it sure sounds like it was Nebuchadnezzar, the manifestation of his empire, the one who took Israel, Judah, into captivity. Is that the origin of Babylon? No, it is not. Well, then why didn't you say so? Because as I already told you, we're actually working backward to try to find the root, the real origin of Babylon, and it wasn't Nebuchadnezzar. Well, if it wasn't, but, I mean, Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon it was an empire that absolutely encompassed the entire earth. So if it wasn't Nebuchadnezzar, what came before? Okay, we're going to go back to Genesis 10. And you know what? You all know your Bible. Because what do we find here in Genesis 10? We have the real origin, asterisks, of Babylon. Genesis 10, verse 8. And Cush begat Nimrod. And he, meaning Nimrod, began to be a mighty one in the earth. Now, you know, don't we wish that God had inspired a whole lot more commentary and detail about these characters and the times, and we'd love to see the stories. And he didn't. But don't doubt that when God inspired through Moses to say, this Nimrod began to be a mighty one in the earth, he meant very strong and very powerful and very influential in the known world. Verse 9, he was a mighty hunter before the eternal. Because all human beings live before the eternal, by the way, in the sight of God. And even as Nebuchadnezzar was the instrument of God, don't think that Nimrod was not allowed to gain power and, in fact, was sponsored to a certain degree by God. No one operates outside of the will or the allowance of this God. He was a mighty hunter before the eternal, wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod the mighty hunter before the Lord. So he even had, you know, there were statements, there was lore, you know, concerning the personality and the accomplishments and the feats of this character. Verse 10, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Well, it wasn't just Babel, but Babel's first on the list. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. But notice, Nimrod had all of it. The beginning of his kingdom, Nimrod's kingdom, included these four different divisions, city, states, whatever you want to call them, centers of power and influence, economy. But they all were in the land of Shinar. Babel is the origin of the name Babylon, which obviously you knew. So maybe we finally arrived at the origin of Babylon. Had to be where the name came from, right? It was Babel, it was Nimrod. What does Babel mean? It means literally confusion, which I'm going to prove to you momentarily. Babel means confusion. So what do you think Babylon means? It's a system of confusion. It still is today. And as we're going to see, we are talking about a system of deception that spans the entire human history upon the earth. Let's go to Genesis 11. Let's see what they did. Under Nimrod and his influence, Genesis 11, beginning in verse 1, the whole earth was of one language and one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east, so there was migrations that took place, and they did from the time that Noah's sons began to repopulate the earth after the flood, and then all of these great peoples that came out of the family of Noah. And here they are now migrating And so the ones that ultimately made their way to this particular area on the earth, which happens to be in the Middle East and probably what is known today as Iraq, came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. This is where they put down their roots. So Shinar, that's where we already found that Nimrod is dominant. This is the center of his power. And they said one to another. So these people are organized together in some type of a government, a structure, a pecking order, and they have big plans. What do they want to do? They said one to another, "Go and let us make brick and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and slime had they for mortar. And that sounds pretty primitive. But they were a whole lot more advanced than we give them credit for in their ability to build and to fulfill their own imaginations, their goals, and their purposes. They had brick for stone and slime that they made for mortar, verse 4, and they said, "Go, let us build us a city and a tower." So we always think about, we focus on the tower, the Tower of Babel. But understand first, it was a city. "Let us build a city and a tower." Tower was just one element that they were building. First and foremost was a city. "Let us build a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven." How high was that? Well, I don't know how many meters or feet they actually achieved. The point wasn't to say they were trying to build a skyscraper to reach, to the moon. But they obviously were building a symbol of their power and their control, because they wanted the awe of all of the people under their control. And this tower was a symbol of their preeminence. But the tower was situated in a city. I would tell you the city is more important than the tower. The city they built was what was important. "And let us make us a name." This is on the list of their goals and aspirations. "Let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." So to them, the worst possible thing that could have happened would have been to be scattered. That's what it seems to imply. What's my bullet point summary of everything we've just read? Here's what we know. Number one, the land of Shinar was given the name of Babel. It was the preeminent city in the land, dominating the others, all under Nimrod. We're going to soon see why it was called Babel. Who gave it the name? It was located in the fertile plain between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, which is why I say modern-day Iraq. Now, don't misconstrue it with modern-day Iraq, because who would even want to fight over that wasteland over there? God calls this here a fertile plain. This was a very, very attractive habitat at that time, unlike what it's become today. Same is true for all of Palestine, by the way. Their purpose, as we read, was to make a name for themselves. And I'm going to say they wanted to make a name in opposition to the will of God.
Oh, where'd you get that?
Hold on. I think I can prove it. They were competing with God. They were trying to set up their own system, their own city, their own governance, their own economy, their own world-ruling enterprise, absolutely in opposition from what God decreed was good and right. And lastly, the Tower of Babel was their attempt after the flood to establish the city, and the Tower of Babel was their attempt to establish a totalitarian world government apart from the rule of God. That was what they were trying to achieve. They wanted to make a name for themselves. And it was going to be within the confines of this city, state, that they were building. To take away the speculations, let's keep reading in verse 5 and see what happened, because that answers a lot. What did God do in response to everything that they did? They decided, this is our plan, this is what we're going to do. They built the city, they built the tower. Then what did God do? Verse 5, the Eternal came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men builded. Oh, they were hot after it, bringing it to pass. The Eternal said, behold, the people is one. Remember what I already saw, one language. Do you know how powerful it is for all people to have one language? Do you know what a handicap it is when human beings don't have one language? We deal with that, don't we? Overcoming the difference in languages in order to fellowship one with another. And thank God for all of you who are bilingual, which make it possible. Because up till now, it has not been God's will to give us the gift of languages miraculously like he did for a time in the first century church. He's left it to all of us who are willing to learn other languages. So language, unanimity of language is an incredibly powerful tool. But it makes human beings vulnerable to the manipulation of certain ones who become preeminent and take control. So God said, not man, not anyone else, God said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do, building their city-state. And now, says God, nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. What? You mean like they can make themselves God? And no. What were they imagining to do? Build an entire world-ruling system that they would dominate. It would be under their control at their whim. Verse 7, go to. So this is what God's going to do about it. Let us go down and there confound their language. How did God interrupt their plans? He confounded the language. Isn't that amazing? He didn't stop their stonemasons or their ability to do anything else economically. All he had to do was divide the languages. Let us go down and there confound their language, and that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Eternal scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. The confounding of the languages actually put an absolute dead stop to their plans to build Babel. Verse 9, therefore is the name of it called Babel. Why is it called Babel? Because of what God did. Isn't that interesting? Therefore is the name of it called Babel because the Eternal did there confound the language of all the earth. So God says it was of all the earth. Now, I thought it was just the land of Shinar, which is a kind of small portion in the Middle East compared to the entire earth. It was the known world. It was the known world at the time. And the people apparently had only migrated within that realm. You know, if Mount Ararat, if that's, you know, where the ark landed and they dispersed out of, you know, Asia, they were still migrating within fairly close proximity in Asia, in the Middle East. But it was the known world. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Eternal did there confound the language of all the earth. and from thence did the Eternal scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. So what's my bullet point summary of that? Number one, God wanted the nations after the flood to scatter to assign domains upon the earth. Well, how do you prove that? Because that is what happened. That's what God forced to happen. That's how I know it was God's will. They had a different plan. They didn't want to scatter. Remember, that's what we read before? They considered that horrible to have these people divide into different groupings and go off and create their own domains. They wanted to keep them all together in one organized area. And it was dominant upon the earth. So you are talking about a world ruling environment. That's why I called it a totalitarian one world government. That was their plan and their design. And God said, uh-uh. Yes, that will come, but not now. It's too early. He confounded the languages. He interrupted their plan. So what we conclude is that Nimrod, therefore, was rebelling against the will of God by trying to keep the people together in one unified civilization under his control. Had God not intervened, man, by the powers of mind that God gave to him and allowed him to possess, would have achieved a totalitarian regime over all peoples of the earth way too soon. Oh, it was going to happen, but in the days of Nimrod, it was way too early. Because this plan by the design of God has to unfold over 6,000 years. Not just about 2,500 years. So God put his thumb on the scale and interrupted the progression toward this one world ruling dominion in opposition to him. And how did he do it? He confounded the language. And bingo, that did exactly what needed to be done for the moment. Confounding the languages was the means to interrupt their plans. So Nimrod said, let's build us a one-world government in the land of Shinar with my personage at the head of it. We'll control the economy. We'll control the people inside the city bounds. We'll offer them protection and security against wild animals, against the threats. That's what they offer you. Cradle to grave, take care of you, provide for all your needs, and in return, you just have to accept us and do everything that we want our way. We're your betters. We're your leaders. We're the intelligent ones who know what to do. For the good of us all, buy into it. And here's this huge obelisk in the form of a tower in the middle of it to make you stand in awe of what it is we're achieving together. So that was their design. And what did God say? No, no, no. Way too soon. He confounded the languages. And then they could not work together to achieve a cooperative result. And what happened? Can you imagine having to go around and find somebody who could understand you and who you could understand? I wonder how many languages it was. And languages continued, you know, to metamorphosize and to change over all this time. But I wonder how many specific different languages there were in that day. But I just imagine the people having to go around and find the ones they could communicate with to the exclusion of all the others. And guess what they did? Then they all grouped together with the ones they could talk to. And Nimrod had only one of the languages. Have you ever thought about that? Nimrod was dominated all of them. And now all of a sudden, he's only got one of maybe, I don't know, half dozen languages, more. It absolutely nullified his power. Because he could only communicate with a fraction of now the human population in the land of Shinar. So they had no choice But first, to amalgamate with the ones who they could communicate with. And then before you know it, what did they do? They went in separate directions. And guess where they went? Where God wanted them to go. Because he gave them appointed domains around the globe, according to his determination. So God used this miracle intervention in order to force them to do what he always wanted them to do after the flood. Isn't it amazing? They didn't want to, but they did it anyway. Because he's the one in control. And that's why you've got the nations who have developed in the known world on the globe where they are. Now, there's been tons and tons of migration since then, and intermingling and changing and turnover and all that. But primarily, we know where the centers of certain races and cultures, national homelands, are situated around the earth. That was by God's design. The other point we can say is that technology today has overcome that original impediment that God instilled. Do we still have the limitation based upon language impeding the ability of human beings to work collectively on the surface of this earth to achieve a common goal? No, we do not. For no other reason, technology. I might say AI, but every version of it. All you got to do is go to Google Translate. Plug in a foreign language and it'll translate it into your language. I use it. It helps me on my travels around the world. You know, I've gone into countries in Asia, especially. Well, it doesn't help me in Europe very much either, but, you know, especially in Asia, and go to Japan and I have a layover for a day. I remember, you know, getting a taxi wanting to go somewhere. You take the first taxi you can get. No way. This Japanese taxi driver understands English. So what do? I pull out my smartphone and I use Google Translate and I speak into it and it translates it into Japanese characters and I show him the phone and he goes, oh, okay, yeah. And off we go. And he takes me exactly where I want to go. And he doesn't speak my language and I don't speak his, but we communicate by technology. So technology today, and that which God gave the mind of man the ability to achieve over time through the Industrial Revolution and everything that's happened, an explosion of knowledge, has now finally nullified that original limit that God put on Nimrod and Babel. Which means, guess what? We're right back where they were. Amalgamating human beings around the globe under a common domain to achieve their own one world government with their nefarious purposes in total opposition to the purpose and the will of God. That's where we are today. But see, God created a delay so that it wouldn't happen until it was time. We're pretty close to the time. No, I'm not giving you dates. Closer than ever before in human history. Here's a citation from a book written by a woman named Dorothy Ruth Miller. It's called A Handbook of Ancient History in Bible Light. This is from page 63. Quote, "The empire founded by Nimrod was apparently of brief duration. At some time before 2000 BC, the Hamitic control of Babylonia," that means descendants of Ham, of the three sons of Noah. It appears, scholars think, originally this land of Shinar, this area in the Middle East, was dominated by the descendants of Ham in particular. The Hamitic control of Babylonia was succeeded by the rule of a dynasty of kings whom historians believe to have been Semitic, meaning they actually predominantly came from Shem. The line of kings is known as the First Dynasty of Babylon. The sixth of this line of kings was Hammurabi. Have you ever heard of him? The sixth of this line of kings was Hammurabi, who has been identified with Amraphel, the king of Shinar. You'll find that reference in Genesis 14:1. Now, I'm not going to say that's a thus saith the Lord. But these kings are listed. They have the biblical names. But there's a lot of secular history which proves the existence of certain kings and their dominions. So Hammurabi was a real king. Dorothy Ruth Miller says, he, this Hammurabi, was a great conqueror and the builder of a mighty empire. We have that cited, by the way. A lot of the material that I'm giving you, even though I'm doing it in my own way during this feast, we have a Church of God, the Eternal booklet entitled Babylonianisms, Historical and Prophetic. So basically what I've done is I've taken a lot of the material in this succinct booklet, and I'm elaborating on it for you during this feast. Lest you think I'm going off on some tangent, this book has been around, what's the date on it? 1989. So if you don't have this book and you're interested in it, you want a summary of historical and prophetic Babylon, I'd say it's in this booklet. Not in the way other churches tried to give you an interpretation of the prophecy, but in a way that's meaty and factual and tells you what you need to understand about it. So this booklet actually cites this particular passage from this secular work called A Handbook of Ancient History and Bible Light, which is why I include it. So I think Mr. Raymond Cole must have believed that there was some value potentially, even if we're not going to say it's a thus saith the Lord. But one of the other reasons why the Bible seems to support the idea that ultimately this land of Shinar became dominated by the descendants of Shem is, guess what? Abram was part of Babylon by birth. Go with me to Genesis 11. Genesis 11, verse 25. Here's another part of the genealogy, which is pretty enlightening. Nahor lived after he begat Terah, 119 years, and begat sons and daughters. And Terah lived 70 years and begat who? Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Verse 27, and now these are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran, and Haran begat Lot. Where did Lot come from? That's how we know that Lot was Abram's nephew. Here's the genealogy of both of them right here. Verse 28, and Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity. And where was that land where they were born and raised? In Ur of the Chaldees. What does that tell us? Guess what? The Chaldeans were none other than the Babylonians. They are the same people. I won't take the time to show you that, but you can look that up for yourselves. When you're talking about the kingdom of the Chaldees, it's the same as saying the kingdom of Babylon in that land of Shinar. That's where they were. So now, whether the original settlers who migrated in there from the family of Noah was Ham and his descendants or not, who ended up there and dominating? These particular individuals of which Abraham was a part. And we know that he was of the family of Shem, right? Yeah, that's the genealogy. And ultimately, descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were none other than the Israelites who descended from Noah through Shem. And so this shows you now that the family of Abram, and they were not paupers. So Abram, his brothers, and their father Terah actually came from a royal family in the land, and it was Babylon. It was the outgrowth of that which Nimrod established. And after the confounding of the languages, even though the rest of the nations, according to language, were dispersed, the ones who stayed put and dominated, at least in their local region, if you will, included Abram. So we've got a lot of other material to demonstrate the fact that Abram literally was of a royal Chaldean family. Why is that important? Because if you understand that, then what happened when God tapped him on the shoulder and gave him a different mission in life? Notice Genesis 12, verse 1. Now the Eternal had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house. In other words, I want you to pack up and leave everything that you have known that has given you comfort and solidarity. And if you understand that Abram didn't come from a poor family, so he didn't have much to lose, well, I might as well leave, I got nothing here. No, he had everything there. He was the intelligentsia, the power in his family, among others, in the Chaldean environment there, which was Babylon. And God said, I have a mission for you, and I want you to drop everything that you know and have been raised to enjoy. And I want you to follow me into the wilderness for the rest of your life. That's what really is described here. Get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee. What was the catch? Yeah, he showed Abraham the promised land and never let him live in it or possess it. So for the rest of his life, Abram was a wanderer. Now, he was a wealthy wanderer. He was not a pauper. He basically was like a sultan or a sheikh, I would say, who had great herds and possessions with his caravan, and he would set up camp, but he never had a permanent homeland from that time forward and continued to be a vagabond, if you will. And even as the New Testament shows us, he traveled all through the promised land, but he never controlled it. That was Canaanite. God called him out of his homeland where he had a seat of power and influence and made him odd man out. What does that have to do with anything? Abram was called out of Babylon. That's the point. His homeland was Babylon. And God said, I want you to come out of Babylon. Does that remind you of anything we read last night? When God says in Revelation to his people, come out of her, my people. So there's your first designated individual in the service of God that God said, come out of Babylon. I have something more important to you, which is totally separate and distinct from what you've been a part of. And you can't have it both ways. And even as Abraham was called out of Babylon, he was Abram and God changed his name to Abraham. Abram was called out of Babylon. We also are required to come out of that very same system. Last text, back to one we read last night, Revelation 18:4. Let's just read it in closing. Revelation 18:4, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins, and that you receive not of her plagues. The end result, he's saying, of Babylon is going to be bad news. It's going to be a curse. You don't want to be anywhere near it because I'm going to destroy it. So symbolically, he made Abram come out of it. And that's going to become a symbol of everything else we're going to see and the requirement of anyone that God is going to deal with. But was that really the origin? So was Babel, was Nimrod? Did we finally find it? I teased you with the idea of Nebuchadnezzar, the golden head of the image. We said, no. I snatched that away from you. I said, no. How about Babel and Nimrod? Looks like it's the beginning, but that's not the beginning either. Next time, we're going to examine even more about the true origins of Babylon that preceded Nimrod. Stay tuned.
the Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented Origins of Babylon in Ancient History, Number 1. The second message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Babylon, Past, Present, and Future. Given for the afternoon service of the first high day of the Feast of Tabernacles in Eugene, Oregon, September 30th, 2023.